Greetings and welcome to The Thirsty Mage, the podcast that it turns out is the true culprit that put the Midgar Swarm on the pike. Yes, we're going to have some fun this episode as we begin our multi-part series covering the future GOAT list-topping RPG, Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. I'm your host, David Lloyd, and yeah, we have a full pub tonight, ready to sing the praises of the Square Enix masterpiece. I know that word's tossed around way too much, but if there was ever a game that deserved it, it certainly seems to be this one. We've got a ton to cover, so we're going to get right into the introductions. We've got the man whose last game featured possibly the best turn-based combat system ever designed. So clearly he refuses to play anything that's not in GOAT contendership. It's Casey Gibson.
Yeah, back-to-back 70-plus hour games. Maybe not the best idea ever, but they've been a doozy, and obviously a Final Fantasy Game of the Year 2024.
Octopath Traveler 2 and then Final Fantasy 7 Rebirth. I don't even know how you top that up. Like it's like your whole gaming, like it's just all downhill from here, I'm afraid. you reach peak gaming.
I've still got some good ones like Elden Ring to revisit, so yeah. It might just be a real good year.
Yeah. But speaking of peak gaming, we've also got someone who's clearly invented a time machine, because I still have no idea how you can play both Unicorn Overlord and Rebirth at the same time and still, you know, eat and sleep and all that stuff. It's Jordan Rudick.
Oh, I'm not sleeping. There's no sleep happening here. The time change has really messed me up. And so I'm like, I'll just stay up an extra hour to compensate every night. And I wake up so tired. Like I'm not sleeping an extra hour, but every night I'm staying up an extra hour. And so that's where the time for the game juggling is happening. Yeah, I rushed to put out my review in progress for Unicorn Overlord, but I haven't stopped playing the game because it's still awesome. I'm still in love with it. And then, you know, when the downstairs TV is free, the bigger TV is free, and I get to hop on for Rebirth, it's a very nice kind of 1-2 punch for me as well. So yeah, it's I'm really taking my time with Rebirth, though. There is no rushing through it at all. There's way too many good games coming out this year that I think are also going to be deserving of time. So and I don't want to rush through Rebirth just to get to those. In good time we will, but yeah, loving my time with it so far.
Yeah, my coworkers, when they tell me that I look like crap, I go, it's definitely not because I stayed up all night playing Final Fantasy. It's like, it's probably a cold. That's probably what it is.
It's my dang it. Kids, it's man. They're feeling me.
Those kids keep me up.
Exactly. That's right. Yep.
And rounding out our Geek Fest tonight is a special guest that will promise one day we'll be on the podcast for a non-Final Fantasy related game. It's Aiden Moher.
Hey, hi. Ogre Battle's back. Final Fantasy VII is back. The 90s are back. It's amazing. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah,
what's the next game that's coming back?
Suikoden.
Oh, yes, of course, exactly. Good, good.
Spiritual successor and a full-on remaster.
Both. You get both, right?
Year Suikoden. Year Suikoden, Ogre Battle, Final Fantasy VII. I can't handle it.
What's old is new again. And
yes. It's good to be good time
too.
To be alive.
I think there's like a legitimate argument to be made that this could be the greatest year in RPG history.
And all of it is kind of blast from the past style, you know, and that's fine. I think it's good to have a mix of like new stuff and returning to old stuff. And especially
when we got that new Atlas game coming.
I was going to say, if Metaphor comes out, there's your brand new game.
Yeah, right. Atlas is crushing it this year. Are they not? Like, love it.
I mean, all RPGs, it seems like it's been a pretty darn good couple of years.
Show me a bad RPG in 2024.
Like, we got Thousand Year Door coming in 2 months from now. Right. Yeah.
Guys, call me crazy, but it might not cost $200 million to make a good video game.
It might not.
I don't know. We'll have to see how much they poured into this, actually.
Well, Rebirth. Yeah, Rebirth might be.
Rebirth.
Yeah. There's a lot of asset reuse. That probably saves some money, right?
Well, that's my biggest thing, is I'm looking at the game going, how in the world did they make this in 4 years?
Hey, like, Final Fantasy, like, 9 and 10 came out, like, in under a year apart, you know? It's
crazy.
Just old school Final Fantasy, like, 4 years between major releases, that was unheard of. Now we've got Final Fantasy 16 and Rebirth under a year apart. It's like we're back in the 90s.
Maybe Square Enix looked at over at Studio RGG and said, hey, they keep reusing assets every iteration. Why can't we?
So that's the trick to putting out a game every 2 years. Right? It's like, oh, we figured it out finally.
The trick isn't to recycle like burnt out development staff. It's to recycle game aspects.
That's right.
And game
that's
assets, right? To like make good games. Anyway. Yep. Anyway.
Well, we got a lot to cover. I'll just let everyone know that we won't be spoiling. Like, we're going to be talking about the introduction part of the game at the beginning and then finish up with kind of a overall look of the grasslands. We won't be talking about anything past that point, basically. Anyone who's started the game, I made the joke about the Midgard Storm at the beginning. Hopefully I pronounced that right. If not, there's your
Stormer. And I saw that. I saw you wrote that in the notes. I'm like, why do you torture yourself like that? Why do you put hard words in the very first sentence?
Rich pays good money to hear me botch words.
Yeah, I knew like, someone had to put you up to it.
Yeah. Like many names created for 90s Japanese RPGs, they were never meant to be said out loud.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It looks cool, though.
Yeah. But yeah, that's the Sephiroth scene there is the where we're going to end tonight. If we even get that far,
I mean it's basically the end of chapter two, so yeah, not very far at all. Yeah,
snake on a pike, right? That's where
snake,
we'll...
on, a snake on a pike. Yeah. Yeah, but there's plenty to talk about leading up to that point, but maybe we'll just start off with our kind of early overall impressions and just kind of get out there where we are so far and what we're thinking of the game so far. How about the guest Aiden? Why don't you kick us off?
Yeah, man, it's good. It's just really good, right? I really liked Remake a lot. I felt like it did a good job of, you know, bringing back the feeling I had when I played the original, right? It wasn't a straight up remake of the original. It wasn't a port of the original, but what it captured and what it did so well and executed on was making me feel like I felt playing Final Fantasy VII back in the 90s. And Midgar was such an interesting case for creating like a closed world, linear RPG experience, which Remake just nailed, and the way that they expanded on, you know, that linear story and gave it room to breathe, gave further depth to some of the characters, worked really well. And then Rebirth was coming, and I said, surely they can't make it a big open world RPG. Surely they can't recreate that huge, vast world from Final Fantasy VII, recreating the feeling of stepping out of Midgar, this whole world in front of you. But they did, and it's just so good. And, you know, I was not a big fan of Final Fantasy 16. I think I talked to you guys about it after the demo or the first 5 hours, didn't I?
Yeah.
And I really liked the first 5 hours.
We'd had some really early impressions.
Yep. Yeah, and they were really strong. And then I felt like the game sort of faltered after that for a variety of reasons. But Final Fantasy VII Rebirth just like, it nails everything that just feels right to me about a Final Fantasy title in a way that like in a mainline release, like in a big console release, like I feel like I haven't felt since like 9, maybe. Like everything else, like as much as I love games like Final Fantasy 12, as much as like I'm a stan for Final Fantasy 15, they were sort of flawed in ways that felt like regressions for the series, whereas Rebirth is just like, it's just pure joy. It's like full of fandom. It doesn't steer away from all the weird elements that came with making a first gen RPG on the PlayStation, and it just embraces history in a way that's really interesting. And then of course it subverts that history narratively in ways that I think are fascinating. So it's good. That's my first impression. It's really, really good.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned like 16. I think the big thing is just the combat. Like 16's combat to me was pretty boring. Like I like the story and all the set pieces and all that good stuff. And it was a, you know, good enough battle system. Like it wasn't horrible.
Yeah.
But then when you jump into, you know, Rebirth here, and it's like, it's funny. At first I was so bad. I'm like, I had to knock the rust off, like remembering how to play.
Yeah. I played Intergrade a few weeks ago to knock that rust off for that reason.
Yeah. I was like sort of getting my butt kicked, not like kicked, but just like I'd kill things. I'd be like, had barely any health left. And then all of a sudden it started to click again. And it's just like, when you put those two battle systems side by side, it's like unbelievable how much better Rebirth is, in my opinion.
Yeah, it turns that traditional Final Fantasy feel of combat into like an action-based combat system that feels really natural while also retaining the elements that I really liked. Whereas yeah, 16 just reduced stuff too much. And I like, I have a lot of thoughts about the combat system in 16 and how I think they had to pull back a lot on what they wanted to do. But it's just wild to play games from two different teams that take the idea, like, let's turn Final Fantasy's turn-based combat into like action-based combat using 15 as a sort of blueprint, and like how they executed so differently, and how one works really, really well for me and the other one just fell flat.
Yeah, well, I was even just thinking myself that this might be the best action RPG that I've played. Like, I'm thinking back to like all the games that are on my like really high up list. Like, they're all turn based, you know, like The Trails in the Sky, Octopath Traveler, the original Final Fantasies, Personas. Like, they're all turn based. I think before this point, I'm Nier Automata or an Automata or whatever might have been like my most favorite action RPG, or maybe even like EZ9 or something.
EZ8,
like that.
EZ8, baby.
Yeah, yeah. So but this just blows it away. Like, it's so like that. It, like you said, it's just kind of this perfect combination of, you know, the action or action combat where, you know, that the hack and the slash, and there is strategy to it. Like, you can't just sit there and spam the square button. Like, you do have to do like blocks and dodges and that sort of thing while you're waiting for everything to. All your meters to go up so that you can do the special attacks and now that they've
synergies got, too.
Yeah, the synergies, like, you know, in the early, like in the Grasslands, I didn't feel like I was doing as many synergies. So I was thinking like, okay, maybe I just don't quite understand how this works. But once you start getting into the heavier combat, like when you take on like the fiends and that sort of thing on the quests, and the combat goes a little bit longer, you really get into that rhythm of, okay, I've got to build up the meter for depending on who you have in your party. And then once you nail those synergies, there's the little cinematic scene while of them doing the moves is just incredible. And it's amazing how seamless everything is.
It's cool too that like when you have two characters doing a synergy, you could switch over to the other person and just keep battling while they do their little thing. Yeah. Like, and it like uninterrupted. It's pretty cool.
And something I wish I had known at the very, very beginning is that now they do make it clear that there is like the affection system from the original game is in place in Rebirth. So it will impact things that happen later in the game. I was not aware, and they probably told me, I just didn't pay attention because I was too busy gawking at everything, that the synergies, like every time you do a synergy with whoever you Cloud does that with, that boosts their affection. So if you kind of get into a groove of doing the same synergy with the same character, that person, that character's the affection will increase at a quicker rate than the rest of the party. So for all those Final Fantasy VII vets out there that know what that entails later in the game, just keep that in mind when you're choosing who's in your party while you're fighting.
So you're saying Cloud and Tifa synergies only. Gotcha.
Yes, I'm not going to spoil anything, but I'm going to just say that I wish I had done more Tifa synergies earlier in the game. It's my one regret so far.
I'm in trouble because I've only been doing Cloud and Aerith synergies. I've been robbing because I played so much of the first game, you know, Cloud, Tifa, and Barret. So this one I've been playing Cloud, Aerith, and Red 13 just for the sake of variety, right? So I'm in trouble in that regard. But I just want to share a quick impression just to see who kind of feels the same way. I find that the minute-to-minute of this game isn't what I'm deriving joy from. I think the minute-to-minute is just fine. But there are moments that come up quite regularly of just pure joy, where like someone will say something, a musical, you know, cue will hit, or you know, even when the summons come out during a boss fight and they do their final, like Ifrit comes out, does his hellfire move at the end of his summon meter, like just little things like that, where like I'm winning battles by the skin of my teeth. I'm not very good at this combat, but I still really like it. But I'm just finding like every couple of minutes or so, there is a small moment that is absolutely golden, just perfect. And it just absolutely sells the game for me, that I know that if I keep playing, you know, I'm going to keep having these moments where I'm just like drip fed this awesome, blissful feeling. And I haven't gotten that from video games very often. Often it's like, you know, it's the loop. I'm finding the loop very satisfying. Here, it's just like individual little moments and kind of hiccups that come up that are just like so magnificent, and just love that part of it for me.
They sucked just like all the joy out of 16 and poured it all into this.
every moment
honestly, all the character. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just like Red 13 is hilarious. Love him. Feel like there's been so many moments where like something has happened and he's made me laugh.
As soon as I saw him on a chocobo, I knew this game was gonna
it's so good.
Yeah. So just like not taking itself too seriously, but in that way being so like honoring the wackiness of that original era of RPG. Mm-hmm. Right, like it's just so absurd. You're like, oh, there's no way they're gonna put him on a chocobo, there's no way they're gonna dress him up in costumes, right? Like nobody would take that seriously, but they do it and it's hilarious and it works and they lean into it. And it just like, as soon as I saw that, I was like, okay, they got it. Like,
yeah,
and they know what they're dealing with.
He climbs the ledge like a human too.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is pretty funny.
Yeah, but that's great.
It's just like, and even just leaning into the silliness, the one quest line. Now I'm going to forget the item you're looking for in the grasslands. I'm guessing it's sort of in each of them. Oh gosh. It was a pretty long quest line where you're chasing down those bandits.
Like it's like a proto relic or something like that.
Proto relic. I think that's what, yep. Yeah. So like just that whole quest line, like finding them and them all being like goobers and like super silly and like they're all like, which one of us has it? You know, and you can see it shining behind the one guy's back.
It's really good. Him.
Yeah. It's just like you said, I think they like, for the main story, it's got a pretty serious tone to it, obviously, right? But it's nice that they're like really leaning into the silliness and the wackiness in the side quests. And you know, even like you said, just aspects of like, yeah, we got Red 13 riding a chocobo over here.
The dialogue in that quest was hilarious. Like Chadley comes up on the little cell phone there, or the cell phone gun or whatever you want to call it. And he's like, well, that's strange. The proto relic seems to be moving away from you. That can't be. And then Cloud's like, I wanted them to get away.
or even with when he chimes in when you're doing the combat related side quests, and like the MIA or MAI, I forgot her name.
Yeah, she's hilarious.
She chimes in and like is stealing his thunder, you know, like, and just to see those two sort of like quip back at each other.
Well, they really get into it too later in the game. It's hilarious.
Yeah, so it you know, it's just awesome that, yeah, they're not taking it too serious or like, you know, like, oh, now that it's in a big, beautiful, realistic world, we got to, you know, cut out the goofiness.
There's a lot of levity, a lot of like lightheartedness, you know, the interactions amongst the party are so charming and beautifully voiced, everything. Like you just spending time with those characters is so fun. And I think that's one of the reasons why you might want to do everything in the world, because you get more character interactions that way, right? If you in the main story, like they might split up and do their own things and whatever when you get to the towns and stuff like that. But if you're going around doing side quests, like everyone kind of has their chance to kind of shine a little bit. Like it's something I noticed about the Grassland side quest, like every character seems to get one that kind of centers on them. And then at the end, at the end of that quest, if you have once completed, you get it boosts their affection, right? And you realize, oh, right, like there's something going on here where they're like showing you moments where Cloud gets to be like kind of one on one with this person and get a little bit closer to them. It's really quite charming.
I was, for a feature I'm working on, I was interviewing the director, Naoki Hamaguchi, and he was kind of talking about how the challenge, like Midgar was very linear and it was like a closed environment, very well defined by the original game, but expanding the scope of the original world to a modern game created a lot of like empty space, empty physical space and empty like narrative space that him and his team recognized early on was really important to fill. Like if you think about Nibelheim, like in the original game, it's like what, 3 flat, like pre-rendered backgrounds, right? And it only shows you the details and only shows you the angle of the village that it wants you to see or it needs for the story. But in this game, it's a fully fleshed out village. So it's, you know, significantly bigger to travel through. And so that made them step back and think, like, how can we fill this out and make it feel like a story or like an environment where people actually live, where story happens. And sometimes that's, you know, filling in, like even that funny photographer, like they kind of gave him a little more personality.
Old Snacks.
He's trying to get, yeah.
Yeah, that's
right. You know, and then you get to Calm, and it's like Calm was a single screen, I think, in the original game. But they wanted this to feel like sort of a vibrant city in modern game design, and so that necessitates it becoming much larger, much more intricately designed, but also full of kind of characters and quest lines that make you feel the same feelings that you had abstractly with the original that was sort of created in your mind. And they needed to actually fill the world with that in a more realistic way, but not like realistic, going for quote unquote realism, but going for realism in terms of like engaging you emotionally in the world. And so that gives you those moments where they said narratively, like there's these big gaps and things that might've felt natural when they were abstracted through the relationship between the player and the game created like sort of abstract emotions, because we filled in a lot of the blanks. Right. But in this game, because the game hues more realistic in terms of its environments, its characters, its modeling, its animations, and just the time it takes to do everything, they said, we need to actually like provide good content that creates that narrative and emotional bridge with the player, which I thought was really interesting, because you feel it, right? You feel it as you wander around the grasslands or Calm or Nibelheim, that you're like, oh, this is like, there's so much new here, but it all feels natural. It feels like something that was in the original game, even though it's obviously not. And I think that the fact that they could recognize that early in the process of creating Rebirth was really impressive.
Well, I think it's funny too. Like Square really could have just cut some corners by doing that whole Nibelheim sequence as like a cutscene or something, like to actually like fully flesh out the village and then have you let you fight as Sephiroth for a bit at the beginning. Just very interesting in the sense that it's like, man, I didn't think they'd put this much detail into this, especially given the fact that like Crisis Core wasn't that far ago. So it's almost, and like the whole time I'm thinking like, I'm not going to spoil it because maybe some people haven't played it, even though it's a very old game, but the whole time I'm like, okay, like I know what's going on here. Like, I know I'm not, what I'm seeing is not exactly reality. But they're just going for it. They're like, no, that's okay. Maybe people have played this or playing this who don't know, the true backstory. And so I'm like, oh, okay, going.
There's so many little details, though.
Yes.
Yeah. Like as somebody who knows the story, you're like, you're that Leonardo DiCaprio, like on the couch pointing, right? Well, like,
yeah. As soon as Cloud started doing the squats.
Yes. Yeah.
That was really good.
Yeah.
Or like so you get good. A glimpse of the soldier, not the soldier, capital letters soldier, but the foot soldier, and he's got a queasy stomach and Cloud's talking to him and you can see a peak of like blonde hair coming out of his helmet. You're just like, your brain's just buzzing at that point. But it also doesn't get in the way of a first timer's experience, because it's not overt, it's not in your face, it's not like asking for your attention. It's just there.
I mean, it's different, right? The way that you interact with these scenes, and just the way that you're exploring these new environment, like kind of new in a way environments, like it's whether you've played the game or not, like you're still getting so much out of these recreated scenes. It's impressive what they've done to kind of carry forward the sensibilities of the original game and continue to make something that feels wholly new as well. Like it's an incredible balancing act.
I really like that you brought up getting to play Sephiroth briefly. And I really liked how you get into combat with him, and like combat doesn't even really last long enough to use his special abilities.
No,
which I think is like totally intentional, strong. Right? Like he has all these cool moves, but like you can't build up the meter fast enough because the monsters just die. And I thought that was really a clever way to show how strong Sephiroth was compared to Cloud.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that was, narratively compelling, but also like engaging in a more interesting way than just showing a cutscene of him like slicing and dicing a bunch of monsters or whatever.
Well, even the interactions with Cloud where he was like, well, no, I'll take on these guys. And Sephiroth was like, oh, okay, like this is kind of cute. I'll let you, give it a try, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I also thought it was like sticking with like that area of the game. Like this is Cloud's personality changes at various points throughout that opening section in Nibelheim, which I think is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
In and around his mom's house. and various other times. He sort of flip-flops around through these various sort of like moods and personalities, which I thought was a really interesting way to portray some stuff that would stick out really obviously to fans, but also kind of plant some seeds for newcomers.
Yeah. Did anyone open Tifa's dresser?
I did not.
No.
Did you really?
Oh, I got scolded for it.
Oh, it's so good.
She gave it to me. I had to see what her reaction was going to be.
I think because you can make a joke, right? Like, oh, I think there was, yeah. I don't know. I didn't do it. I couldn't.
Like, I thought about it, but I didn't. Oh, like, something like that.
So good.
Yeah. I did.
So what was in there?
I don't think it's a carry
Cloud, script. Cloud sort of like bashfully quickly closes it. And then Tifa and Aerith call him an ass.
Yeah.
In tandem, it's still good. The comedic timing and the comedy is just.
I'll have to look that up on YouTube. I couldn't risk Tifa's relationship.
Yeah,
no, that was what threw it. Points.
Yeah, that's exactly what threw it in my mind. I was like, I can't sacrifice any affection points. I'm not going to do it.
maybe if it was Aerith, it would have been okay.
Yeah.
The throwing Aerith under the bus to the start of this podcast series is really good.
I'm an Aerith fan. So
there we go.
I got
a plus one there.
I've always been a Tifa guy, but like Aerith, she's just so cute. It's hard to not love her. Also, you know,
she's.
I love Aerith, but Tifa and Cloud. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's meant to be.
Yeah, it's meant to be.
I kind of like though Tara. That they didn't lean into like love triangle like conflict between Tifa and Aerith and Cloud like. I really like that Tifa and Aerith are like BFFs and like constantly sort of ragging on Cloud and like they have chemistry. Like the fact that the characters outside of their relationships with Cloud feel like they have their own relationships. Like Tifa and Barret have a really strong relationship outside of Cloud. Aerith and Tifa calling Cloud when he admits to going through Tifa's closet is just like, that's such a wonderful bit of character and not even world building, but like relationship building in a game that like it didn't need to do, right? It could have just skipped that entirely because it was kind of weird in the original, but instead they leaned into it, saw an opportunity to turn it into something that built up not just Cloud as a character, but Tifa and Aerith as individuals and as friends, which is pretty cool.
I think they still like to poke fun at the love triangle though, right? Because when you go up to the clock tower in Calm, right? Like, and you all rejourn at whatever point, like she sort of, Aerith has your arm like, oh, we're on a date or something. And Tifa is sort of like,
Yeah.
But then something else happens and then it wasn't even really addressed, I don't think. So,
yeah. But Tifa's always like, man, what's up with Cloud guy? Like he wasn't like in Nibelheim. Like, I don't remember that.
Yeah.
Like, what is he talking about? Like
he's lucky he's good looking.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, it's interesting how there's that complexity with Tifa's relationship with him. Cause she like, I think there's like chemistry in the moment, but there's also like uncertainty with his past and
yeah, what like, who is this is. Guy? Like,
well, I think it's interesting that Sephiroth is trying to divide him and Tifa. Like I'm curious if this is going to be something that that whole aspect of like things have changed. It's not exactly the same. Like does Sephiroth know that there's like some kind of benefit of them? Like he needs to break them up because they're too powerful together or something like that. Like, you know, the only way I'm going to win is if Cloud doesn't have Tifa supporting him or there's something to that effect. Yeah.
Or like the other way is Sephiroth trying to push Cloud toward Aerith to make, you know, things happen in a different manner or something,
true.
You know, like what is it? Cause I
what's his plan?
Yeah. Like based off remake, not based off anything in Rebirth. Like to me, this is like, it's a remake and it's a sequel. Right. And like Sephiroth has seemingly perfect knowledge of the events of the original game. I kind of am of the mind that Aerith also has knowledge, maybe imperfect knowledge of the events of the original game.
I think she does too, to some extent.
As someone who's played further into the game, I wouldn't go down that road.
Interesting. Okay.
It will be addressed.
Okay.
So you've nailed it. We've solved the puzzle here.
I guess so.
It hasn't been fully addressed yet, but soon, based on where you guys are, it will soon be explained
things will become more clear.
The situation.
Okay, I think I'm playing up to the golden saucer tonight, so we better wrap this up soon.
Yeah. You don't have to go that far. Okay, maybe okay, good, I think just to Costa del Sol, but potentially.
Interesting.
See, when I get to Costa del Sol, I want to stay there forever because I love that. That music just puts me in the best place in the world. Like, I think about that music all the time. I love that scene.
What I said about Costa del Sol to Casey stays between the two of us, but Casey knows.
So when you guys get to a new zone, have you been going out and doing all the exploration stuff before pushing the story, or have you sort of like, let me do the main story and then sort of double back? Because when I first got into Grasslands, after I got out of Calm, I pretty much went and just did everything else. Actually, I instigated the very end of the Grasslands by accident trying to get somewhere, and then I had to double back to get like the last thing on my checklist. But yeah, now that I'm in Junon, and we're not going to go into any spoilers there, but essentially I'm sort of doing the same thing where, you know, I've done a few bits of the main quest, but now I'm sort of just lapping up all the extra stuff to do and Queen's Blood and all that good stuff.
Yeah, I wasn't going to 100% everything. I fully did not intend to do that. And then I did in the Grasslands because I just didn't want to stop. I think that, like, we were sort of talking offline before we started recording about, I think the open world design in this game is really interesting because it obviously takes nods from a lot of, like, open world design from Western games. But it also doesn't have a bajillion icons on the map. Like, you know, like something like Horizon. When I open up my map in Horizon, there's, like, a bajillion icons.
It's overwhelming.
Toggling them on and off, and some of them are important, some of them aren't.
So it's not an Ubisoft game.
It's overwhelming. It's not an Ubisoft game. No. It has obviously inspirations from Ubisoft, but you go up and you activate a tower and you get like three or four new icons, but they're also sort of laid out in a way that naturally guides you through the environment, which I think is really interesting. And each time you kind of sort of activate or complete, you know, a tower or a life spring or whatever, it pops up a couple more and they're kind of nearby and they're kind of in the path you're already going. And in that way, it just feels more natural and less overwhelming than a lot of like Ubisoft games or Western open world games. And so in that way, it was like, well, yeah, I want to keep going with the story. I'm especially curious to find out how the story's changed and all of that stuff. But there was just one more icon and it was just over that ridge. And so like, I just kind of continued down that and I felt like I was getting meaningful, you know, reward for doing so. And, you know, so I did the Grasslands and I was like, okay, that's it. Like, I'm not going to 100% everything because I'm going to get burnt out, which is what happened to me with like Horizon. It happened to me with Tears of the Kingdom recently. I try to do everything and I burn out after 50 hours. But that, sure enough, I got to, you know, chapter 4, which is another open world area. And I couldn't stop myself. And I'm like 3/4 of the way through all the little icons and the story has been put on pause. But
I mean, the way they drip feed everything by you go to one point on the map, it opens one more, or you go to one of the towers, you unlock a tower, you get a little scene, it opens two more things, right? I think that doling out of things very carefully in a very measured way, very, very clever, that I think a lot of other open world games haven't figured out. They've kind of taken the more of a shotgun approach where it's like, oh, you go to this new area, there's 30 things to do, 50, 70, whatever, and it keeps growing and it keeps becoming more and more. And it's like, okay, you'll never have a shortage of things to do. Yeah. This game isn't like that. It's more like, if you want to do a couple things here and there, you can do that. If you want to go forward or go back to the town, you can do that. There's that kind of, there's a breeziness to it that's really nice. There's the fact that you can kind of see yourself completing these smaller tasks and then kind of moving on and doing something different. I love how the Chocobo farms kind of function as little hubs for you where you can, that's kind of where you do fast traveling, right? So you fast travel between regions by unlocking the Chocobo farms. And it's such a cool little neat twist of like, that's where you go to move to the other one. You get a little carriage. Like, it's so cute. Like, just again, little touches that are making this game for me. Not the whole package is great, but it's these small little things I'm discovering and seeing ways they're kind of playing with mechanics of the game, but in a very kind of dressed up, cutesy way, just oozing with charm. And you can tell like people's fingers kind of all over this game, right? Like, it's very kind of tailored like that.
You know, like, as we're talking about this, one thing I feel like the game structure reminds me of is it's not really an open world game in the same way as Horizon or Zelda, where you can basically go wherever you want, right? And that reduces the ability to create like sort of a guiding hand. It kind of reminds me structurally of like big PC RPGs like Baldur's Gate or Icewind Dale. We have these open environments with lots of options, lots of quests within them, but they're still self-contained, right? Like you can't climb over the mountains from the grasslands to Junon. There's still sort of like a linear passageway between them. So they're closed off from one another. There's smaller subregions that match up well with, I think, like older PC RPGs. And I think the combat kind of goes back to older PC RPGs because it's a real time with pause combat system. And I'd be really curious to hear how they sort of, if it was intentional or if this is sort of like a melding of like, you know, console RPGs from the 90s were sort of sectioned off into like dungeons and towns scattered over an abstract world map, and extrapolating that outward sort of brought them, you know, into the same place as PC RPGs, or if there was sort of a design influence from some of those games. You know, we're seeing Baldur's Gate 3, which is obviously huge, didn't influence Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, but it also has those sort of like big open zones that are, you know, filled with things to do, but they are separate from one another. And Rebirth is kind
even
of
even
like
a Xenoblade that. Chronicles 3. It did that kind of thing with zones too, right? The Xenoblade games have kind of experimented with this since they started, right? Like they these really big open spaces with things to do, not like overwhelming, you know, but the space, the physical space can feel overwhelming in those games. There's just a lot of room to run around, to tread. Chronicles X does a fantastic job of eventually opening it, you know, albeit dozens of hours into the game, opening it up. And then you get this sense of scale of like, wow, like now I can zip through things and just seeing things from different perspectives and stuff like that. Like this game, there's a little bit more of there's verticality to it, right? That there's places where you're kind of like negotiating with the terrain, you know, having to get up this part, or whether you want to use a chocobo to get to a certain area a little bit faster or in a different way. Like the way that it's playing with space, something I wasn't really expecting or thinking too much about, thinking about, you know, what Disc 2 would be, that the post Midgar stuff would look like. I wasn't thinking about like the navigating the terrain as much, but I am kind of noticing that a little bit more, having a little bit more fun with it too.
Well, it's neat that the side quests kind of gate off some of the areas too. Like it's not 100% accessible. Like when I was I can't remember, there was like something, I think I had saw something up on the bit, there was like a hill kind of above Calm that had like an amazing, I think I just wanted to see Midgar, see if I could see Midgar from like the tallest point that I could see. And so I'm looking at the map. I'm like, okay, clearly there's only one way to get there. But when I got there, there was a locked door, like a fence with a locked door. And I'm like, oh, okay. Like this must be a story thing later on. And then it was the proto relic.
The last part of quest. It, right, I believe.
Yeah. So where it's like you end up finding the key at their hideout. And then that gives you the access to that area so that you can go up and kind of get the proto relic, complete the quest. But now you have access to the tallest point. And then when you look down, it's just incredible because you see like all of the Mako piping coming out of Midgar, and you see like the ocean and it's funny. They kind of did a perfect, you know, you're leaving kind of the grimy Midgar, and then the first place you end up in is Calm, which like absolutely beautiful place. they really nailed like the how just. I don't know. It looks like a village out of Europe or something. It's just like everything looks incredible.
And in the intel too, they say how like, you know, they have to send all the Mako from Midgar all the way out there because they don't have like any generators or anything. And that's why it's so like nice and not so crummy, you know?
Well, they even make Aerith talks about like when you first get it, leave Calm and you kind of have that, moment of like
the Breath of the Wild moment,
where it's like, look at all the space that you can see, and then Aerith is like, man, you know, there are places here where the planet's not completely dead, like this is,
yeah. And then Red 13's like, trust me, it's dead.
There's this great,
it's right almost there. Earth.
There's this great little moment. You do one of the side quests, sort of in like, because you start off in the really nice verdant area of the grasslands, but if you kind of go back towards Midgar, it gets all rocky and depleted. You know, where the Mako energy's all been sucked up. But as you're doing one of the quest lines for Kyrie, is that what her name is?
Oh, the one that was to be the Merc?
Yeah, the Merc, right?
Yeah.
You have to, like, patch up one of the Mako pipes. But at where the Mako is all spilling out, it's all like, it's again, like all verdant in like sort of a semicircle around that crack in the Mako pipe. And I thought that was a really interesting way of, you know, subtly showing like, oh, like the grasslands are verdant because the life of the planet is there and it's vibrant and it's feeding, you know, the world. But you can see here what happens as Shinra continues to like, you know, drain every last drop.
Well, and hilariously, the enemies you fight there are those giant mushroom men, right? Like a perfect encapsulation of what's happening to the planet. Mm-hmm. It's creating these, you know, terrible, like,
mutants.
It's taking something like, you know, wonderful, like, sustenance mushrooms that people would eat and making something grotesque and monstrous out of them, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yep.
Yeah, Kairi is, again, another terrific dialogue. Like, I love, oh, I think her Erica Harlock or something like that. She's like the voice in like everything, like Japanese, like the Persona, like Anne from Persona, and every other game you could think of. The interactions between Cloud and her are hilarious. Then the whole, like, you know, we'll do this for you as long as you stop calling yourself a merc.
Yeah.
And then she just immediately like forgets the deal right away, and
which is funny given Cloud's spoilery history, right? Mm. That he's going around sort of questioning people.
Yes, exactly.
Right. You know, like, project and the labels that they claim for themselves. Which is obviously funny. What did you guys think of traversal in the game? Like, how do you feel running around the world? I think it
could be sort of annoying, especially when you're on a chocobo.
Yes.
And yeah, it definitely sometimes it's a little annoying.
I just came off Tears of the Kingdom. Like, I finished it a couple of weeks ago before starting Rebirth. And it's like really jarring how inelegant like traversal.
Yeah.
You get caught
especially
up
because you start in a really rocky vertical like area with lots of ups and downs and dips and valleys. And you can't climb anything unless there's like the ridges.
Unless they got the Resident Evil yellow paint on it.
Yeah. I'll forgive it because it is, you know, like, it's such a big game. But I do feel like traversal could be a little easier. Like, Cloud could climb a little faster, couldn't he?
I hate how you can't drop down. Like, you can't drop down from every space.
Yeah.
Like, it has to be like only a short distance. I'm like, really? Like,
and, like, I understand that that's, like, a whole layer of complexity more than what they've done. You know, we're not going to get Tears of the Kingdom out of everything, but at the same time, like, I just wish it felt a little better to wander around.
Even some, like, in the beginning portion in Nibelheim, like, after, you know, like, the town's on fire and I think that tree, like, hits you.
Yeah.
And, like, you're walking around and I'm like, okay, like, I get he's hurt, but man, they really had you walk a pretty far distance. hobbling.
Too. I like the slow walk. It was in Remake 2 all the time. I like it.
The crawling at the end of that sequence was agony. It was absolutely, I know Cloud's agonizing too. We're feeling his pain, but
they did a good job for sure.
You had to earn that gameplay.
Yeah.
You needed to suffer.
I'm this at like 2 minutes, 3 minutes, please just let me get to him.
I like the guys in that scene, all the like the villagers with their guns just standing around.
He's like, shoot him, just
like, shoot him. Yeah, like, you know, standing around Sephiroth, just like saying they're going to shoot him. And it's like, it goes on forever and ever.
One gets stabbed and like the other two don't shoot yet. And then the next guy stabbed and the third guy still doesn't shoot. Like, what are you waiting for?
And like, all they really needed to do in that scene was like have one of the random guys shoot him and then Sephiroth just like, you know, he deflects the bullet and cuts him down, right?
Yeah,
like, just some anime move. And then the other guys are like, they're too scared to actually try to shoot him at that point. And then the scene plays out the same. But the fact that they just all sort of stand around there with their guns or whatever is just like
now,
it's pretty comical.
We're not paid enough for this.
Yeah. And fair enough, they're not. Right?
But you're so terrified you can't even pull the trigger because Sephiroth is just so imposing. That sword is just so ridiculous.
Maybe that's what they were going for. What's the point? You know, there's no point. This is like the strongest man on earth. Why are we even bothered?
Yeah.
They're busy having their lives flash in their heads, right? Like,
I guess I wanted to just even talk a little bit, just going back to more with the exploration and how it all sort of feeds into itself with all the different systems, right? Obviously, as you're traveling, there's all sorts of materials all over the floor, and then you can use it in the item transmuter, which I love that it's
I love it.
Yeah. I love that it's not just like, oh, okay, here are the three items, or like, oh, you maybe you buy a plan or something. I like that you actually earn experience and level up.
And by, you get by new things that. Open up. It's so clever. It, like, why don't other games do this? It's so good.
And like, it the works stuff so craft well. Is good and useful. Like, I legit wear some of the armor that I craft in the item transmuting, and like, I make potions to you.
I love making the like the mist potions, dude. Yeah. For it's like, ooh, let's go.
Yeah, like the fact that it's not just a superfluous system to make you feel like you should run around gathering supplies. It's like, oh, I want to get, I need these because I want this certain item.
Yeah,
like, you're gonna keep finding the life stuff
because it's such a useful system, right? And then you get there's sometimes where you have to craft like a quest item or something like that, so you're even more incentivized to always have a stock of whatever is on the ground.
Yeah,
and like, then you just find the, that like, life spring, and it's like, oh my god, materials out the yin yang. So
just the fact that they have like, and I know that like it's not the first game to do this, but the fact that they have the little icons. But the, you know, the normal items are white, and the rare ones are gold. Yeah. And I use the Moogle charm, which I think like. I got with as a pre-order bonus or something, and it like makes it slightly more likely that I'll get like rare materials on the ground, and I just like I eat it up, man. Like I just like run from gold item to gold item. Like,
so that's why you spent like 20 hours in the grasslands, Aiden, right? 100%.
Like, gotcha. I was maxing out on iron ore, well before I was down the grasslands. But then I sell it, and that's how I've also like like gotten cash to buy materia and stuff like that. So it's
And then that too, right? Crafting materia yourself, and how do you do that? By doing the intel and getting different, you know, all the points for doing all the things as you're
together
exploring. And then even right, like it seems, I'm guessing I'm in two zones now, that it seems like each zone you sort of unlock a new summons materia, or you can and you by going around and finding the data points and almost doing like a little rhythm-esque mini game before doing it will reduce it, because when I went to battle it the first time, I got my butt kicked.
Me too. Yeah, me too.
And I was like, is this the rust? Or and then I realized as you find those data spots, you can make it weaker and significantly weaker if you find all of them. And then, you know, I went online. I'm like, well, am I going to get like a crappy version of this materia if I do it weak? But no, you get the same reward. So it, you know,
well, they're actually stronger.
Yeah. It's like, inversely. Oh,
yeah.
All right. Well, even better then. Yes.
It makes them easier to beat, but then stronger as a summon.
But it's cool because you can also choose what difficulty. So like you want the strongest version of Titan. You can go collect all of the, you know, the three points around the map so that you get the strongest beefed up version, but you can also choose to fight them at the highest difficulty if that's your thing. So you're not forced into doing it on the easiest difficulty just to have the most powered up version of Titan. Like, it's just little like design choices like that that really make the game player friendly and allow people to sort of approach it in whatever the way that they want to, which I think is really smart.
Speaking of rhythm games, has anyone else played the piano?
Ooh, I was just doing that before we played, actually. I got an A on the first song. It took me a minute to realize how to do it.
It's actually pretty clever, though.
It's very clever.
It's super smart.
Yeah. I played a lot of it in the demo. I haven't gotten to the point in the game yet where it's reappeared. Because when you go during the Nibelheim flashback, you just don't have any songs. So you can play the piano, but you have
you're close. You're close. Am
I? Okay, yeah. But I thought it was great. I'm not really a rhythm game fan for the most part, and I don't really have a lot of musical ability, but the simplicity of it, like I can't hit the double notes where I have to
move both
thumbsticks to hit a note at, you know, at the same time. Like, I just don't have that, but I can sort of stumble through the songs, and they sound pretty good if I've practiced a few times, and that sort of reward, you know, which is like classic for rhythm games. But the fact that, like, I know there's a lot of mini games later on, the fact that they managed to like fill the world with mini games that, like, you know, at least the music one and Queen's Blood, they're good too, right? Like, they're legitimately compelling mini games. And designing a mini game is way different than designing like an open world.
There's, you know, like
quest line.
A bajillion mini games to the point where I'm like, are these guys competing with RGG? Because this is ridiculous. Like, I'm
the original was like that. right? There was a submarine game.
Yeah, there was so many.
Like, I can't wait to go snowboard.
Yep. One-on-one brawling game. There was snowboarding. There was, you know, like there was a bajillion mini games in the original too. And I think there's even more in this one, but that's another kind of callback to the original that I appreciate.
And we haven't even talked about Queen's Blood.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ooh-wee.
I was going to say that we got a segue of mini games to Queen's Blood. You do that for a minute. I want to talk about the music afterwards because I've just been smitten by this soundtrack so far.
So good.
But do Queen's Blood first because we're already at mini games.
Yeah, Queen's Blood, it surprised me, right? Like you get the deck on your door, on your hotel room door there. And I was like, okay, whatever. But yeah, as I play it, it's like, oh my goodness, this is actually super fun. And then it's really cool obviously we've been talking about pretty much going to a new zone and just being tons of things to do. But the first thing always on my list is sort of that Queen's Blood.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to get into the particulars of how it's played, but the games are pretty quick and it's addicting.
Yeah.
And you win cards, you could buy cards from different vendors and you could just sort of build out your deck. And anytime I get to a new zone, that's like really the first thing I'm doing is like, all right, let's go beat some jabronis at Queen's Blood. And it seems like everyone I've seen online, like everyone seems to really be loving Queen's Blood.
I would be shocked at this point if we don't get a standalone Queen's Blood game.
Yeah, like Gwent, right?
Like Gwent, right?
Yep.
Yeah. It's like, I play a lot of card games. I play a lot of Magic the Gathering. And like, so I feel like I have a pretty good idea of like when a card game is like good, and I think Queen's Blood is like legitimately just a well-designed card game. And when you read, like, at first you go in and you're like, oh okay, I just like number go up, I just need big numbers, right? And then you lose a few matches and you're like, oh no, this isn't a number go up game, this is like a
field position
game. Yeah, and it's all about battlefield positioning and territory, and you're like, oh, this is like, you know, Catan almost in terms of like, you know, without the randomness and all that, but like it's about controlling territory and understanding how your opponent can control territory. And you're like, oh, this is like so much deeper and more complex than I thought it would be. You need to play it with humans. Like the fact that you can't play, at least, through chapter two, you can't play against like your friend. Like I think the game will only get better when humans can play against each other.
Well, it's got to be a cash cow because if you start charging money for cards.
Yeah.
Like,
oh boy. Yeah.
And if they make it like a stand alone, like, I don't know, just it seems like it'd be like a good mobile phone game, right? Where it's like
Hearthstone, right?
Like, yeah.
There is a Final Fantasy card game that exists, and I'm telling Square Enix right now, toss it out the window, burn them
just
all.
Just do Queen's Blood.
Just do Queen's Blood. You will make a fortune. Absolutely. You'll never have to worry about money again. Like, it could be like Pokemon card crazy in the sense like that you could have all the characters have their own thing.
Yeah.
And it's funny too because it's very in the realm of Triple Triad in its kind of spirit or whatever, but it follows in the sense of like when you first are playing Triple Triad in Final Fantasy VIII, the rules are very simple and they just get more and more crazy as the game goes on, and that's Queen's Blood. It's just getting crazier and crazier, like as the game goes on. Like,
the cards get
more advanced. Like, there's abilities. They start changing rules. Like, it's just nuts.
I figured the abilities would probably start to ramp up because I feel like I've got a number of cards that don't have any abilities.
Yeah,
and there's definitely a couple cards. I'm like, I need to get rid of this stupid card, man. Like, there's one. I'm sure there's probably a lot of people who are like getting really into the weeds building out these different decks.
Oh, for sure. Well, Jeremy Berger is the music before.
We got into some of the music because that was emotionally, that was the thing that hit me the hardest when I got into this game. And I guess after the kind of prologue with the Nibelheim and you get to Calm and you go to the grasslands, like I think even in Calm, like just the music there was hitting me. Like, it's just like, oh my gosh. The smooth jazz, like just the way they've taken the old remastered it, remixed it, whatever. Like, it's just I felt like so kind of just emotional. My chest was kind of tight. I'm like, oh my gosh, like this is going to be a thing. Like, this is going to be a big part of my life this year, is this game and this experience playing it. on the other side of that is like, how many different versions of the Chocobo theme are we going to hear? Like, three or four or five so far.
They only continue.
How many versions? How many ways are they going to play the same song in a different way? But I love them for it too. Like it's very playful. But yeah, I think it's an incredible. I mean, the remake was a really good soundtrack too, and I love the versions of that. I think this is going to be even bigger.
Like broader, right? There's just more to it. All bring new sort of inspirations and sounds into the mix. And
it's not just like 10 different versions of the battle theme or a boss theme. It's all the different cities and areas that you're visiting now.
7 was really interesting too on the PlayStation because it was like the music was good, but the instrumentation was really bad, right? Like bad. It wasn't well made. And Uematsu's talked about that. And he's talked about how he saw what they did was Suikoden with like real instruments and how CDs are kind of unlocked higher quality sound that like 8 sounds so much better, but 7's soundtrack is pretty good. It's very iconic. The melodies are really strong. It's really memorable. And to see that brought forward in a way that feels modern but calls back to the originals is unique to me because we've moved into a place where like, can you guys hum a single song from Final Fantasy 16?
I can. There's a few. Yeah. I've got a track, a Get Pumped track.
Yeah, a Get Pumped track. Because like,
not off the top of my head,
something like that, or something for the flame.
That's the one. It's like really good. The boss theme.
That's the strongest song.
And like 16 has a fantastic soundtrack. So does 15. But like games, and Uematsu, I think, was talking about this today, that games have like sort of shifted towards more like orchestral mood driven. Movie style soundtracks instead of melody driven soundtracks. And I think what's so interesting about Rebirth is it brings those really, really strong melodies from the PlayStation era into sort of the modern era and makes them feel new and fresh and contemporary while also being driven by like hummable melodies, which I think is just, you just don't get that a lot anymore, especially in big budget games. Like, God of War has a fantastic soundtrack. But it's just, I think the guy that did God of War soundtrack also did Lord of the Rings, like the Rings of Power. Yeah. And like, those are two very, very different experiences, right?
Yeah.
But gaming has sort of like wanted to veer cinematic in that way. And Rebirth is sort of a melding of what I really loved about video game music. Back in the day, my dad would catch me and my friends like listening to whatever Final Fantasy VI music that we were like recorded on a cassette. Right?
He'd be like, what are you
doing? Like, or we'd be downloading MP3s off Napster of like Final Fantasy 7 soundtrack.
David's
like,
FF6 cassette right beside him right now. I think he's still listening to that on your tape.
Well, it's funny because I have Spotify and Square Enix has like a channel, and every day, every morning at work, I look and I'm like, where's my Rebirth? Where's my Rebirth soundtrack? This is unacceptable. So I just
gotta hit up YouTube. I'm sure it's there.
Yeah, I just make my coworkers listen to everything else on Square Enix, and then I force my children to listen to it in the car. And
I know that we're jumping ahead a bit here, but the Junon like world theme is just, it's so good with Winwoods start like coming in, and you're just it's so good. And like
there's no better
feeling in gaming than coming up on a life spring. And like the world music fades away, and then that like slow melody kicks in that just brings you right back to watching the opening cinema in the original with Aerith walking through Midgar. And you're just like, this is like, I didn't know if I could recapture the feeling I had as a teenager playing some of these RPGs, but it's pretty close.
They're like distilled nostalgia hotspots. You're a crystal of nostalgia.
It's like the crystals are our crystallized nostalgia.
That's right. That's right.
They just know what to do with it. Katase and Hamaguchi and all of them, they know how to get right.
Final Fantasy is crystals, baby. Like that's the name of the game right there. So of course that's where they're going to do that.
Absolutely.
Fantastic though.
So good.
Yeah. Well, we're coming up in an hour and, we've gotten through it with just the grasslands, and
we're starting to spill into Junon talk. So we're supposed to wrap up. Yeah, right?
It might be time to wrap up.
Yeah.
I guess what I'll say is Casey and I are going to be doing a Queen's Blood episode that's only for the Patreon. So if you enjoyed this episode and you want to hear more about Queen's Blood, we're going to get into the weeds in a Patreon exclusive podcast that'll be coming out. I guess let's say
we're recording this week, so within the next couple, I imagine
it'll be soon. So if you're on the fence about joining the Patreon, now's a great time to do it. Patreon.com/thethirstymage. But we'll definitely have more episodes on Final Fantasy Rebirth, 7 Rebirth as we go along. I think we're gonna do like, I don't know if we'll necessarily
at least six
do like one
or
episode
seven more
per,
episodes
per region,
per region, yeah,
per region per chapter. I don't know if it'll be that crazy, but. But yeah, like I think I'm in chapter 8 or 9, and man, like it's not quitting. It's just it's incredible, and there's no shortage of things to swoon over. So
game of the year, baby.
Yeah, if you enjoy Final Fantasy, this is going to be your month to shine, because you're just going to get it drip feed into an IV right into your veins.
Casey's calling it in March, game
of
the year.
I'll go one further than that. Like 2023 was the year of the banger, right? Like there was Baldur's Gate 3, there was Final Fantasy 16, if that was your thing, Street Fighter 6, Tears of the Kingdom. Rebirth to me would have been game of the year last year, above all of those other games that like I'm a
Yeah,
with.
I think so too. Yeah.
But to me, like nothing, like not even Tears of the Kingdom, not even, you know, like Sea of Stars, I love, like all of those, like they're incredible games. Rebirth would have beat them all for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, unless it takes an incredible nosedive in the back half, which I'm fairly confident it doesn't based on people who have beaten it. It just captures everything I could have hoped for from a remake of
You could say it's the game of the 2020s, at least the front runner as we speak.
I'm looking at my backlogged top RPGs list, and I'm just like right at the top. I'm just looking like, you're gonna fit in here. We'll see how close you get to number one, but
yeah, it's like it's right there. The only thing I think holding it back is narratively middle portions of stories are kind of a challenge. You know, they kind of start in the middle of something and end in the middle of something. So I can see that sort of holding it back a little bit, but I don't know. It's just such a joy to play. It just feels so good.
One could argue that Empire Strikes Back was the best Star Wars.
It is the second best Star Wars. It's funny. Star Wars is the one where the middle movie is always the best one.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah.
Well,
all right, should we call it here? We'll do our little plugs and everything, and then everyone get off the podcast. We'll go play at least an hour or two before bedtime. right now, I think.
So. Get a little more when we can.
Yeah, exactly. Really great to finally talk about this game. We've been looking forward to it for forever, it feels like. And obviously, the impressions are pretty glowing, pretty positive. We're all like in kind of different aspects of the game, which is cool too. Thanks to Aiden for joining us. Aiden, you want to plug what you're working on, what's been going on with you lately since we last chatted?
Yeah, so I have a book called Fight Magic Items, which is the history of Final Fantasy, Dragon Quest, and the rise of Japanese RPGs in the West. That's available anywhere you can buy books. I have a newsletter called Astrolabe, where I write about video games, books, and video game books, which, you know, recently I've written about the passing of Akira Toriyama, the passing of Yoshitaka Murayama, who created Suikoden, along with a whole bunch of other things, Sea of Stars and video games and Final Fantasy and all the fun things that people like to read about, who also listen to this podcast. I presume they like Final Fantasy. And
I enjoy it. I'm a subscriber.
Thank you. So I'm working on that. And then I have a book that I finished. It's in an editorial right now, which I think would also be of note to... you know, to some of the people who listen to the podcast. And most recently, I was on IGN with a big feature about parents who are introducing their kids to Final Fantasy through this remake series and sort of revisiting their love of the original game through the eyes of their, you know, their preteens and teens and other young loved ones. And so that was a really great opportunity to talk to the team that, you know, behind Final Fantasy. So I talked to director Naoki Hamaguchi, and I also talked to some parents about their experiences, and that's on IGN.
Very cool. Casey, you want to plug anything?
Chugging away over Talk Nintendo podcast every week. I believe actually you're joining us next week, correct?
That's why I brought that up, because I'd like to join you guys, you jabronis, next week. So
for Undertale.
Yeah.
Next week, and then yeah, before you know it, it's going to be episode 400. Wow. I almost said 300, but it's 400.
Nice.
Crazy.
I can't believe, yeah, you guys have been doing it for a long time. Good for you. That's awesome. It'd be a nice milestone to hit. Obviously, we just celebrated our 250th, so that was cool, the Thirsty Mage. David, want to plug anything here? Give people the links, the Discords, the things like that.
Yeah, I guess the kind of hub to everything, the Chocobo Farm to our core enterprise here is thethirstymage.com. So you can get access to the Discord where we have a channel that we're talking about Rebirth, and it's safe for spoilers. We are using our spoiler tags, so you can come in and have a chat. There's been a few times where people have like brought up, asked for help or something, and were given some guidance. Or I would say 90% of the talk is just gushing over this and that.
Of course.
Did you see this? Yes, I saw it. It's crazy. There's tons of that. So yeah, it's a terrific place to kind of share the experience with over at the Discord, which again, like I said, you can get through the website. I'm finally up to date on getting the episodes up on the website too. So if you want to see kind of the back catalog, a little bit easier, even writing articles for the podcast episodes now. I think I've done that for about 5 or 6, and will be going forward. So we got some more stuff there, and yeah, we got like I said, there's the backlog list if you want any kind of RPG recommendations that you can get through the website as well. And yeah, just plenty of RPG goodness.
Sounds good. Yeah, we're off to a fine start in 2024. I think it's going to continue, and we've got many more hours to lose ourselves in the world of Rebirth. So stay tuned for the next episode on that. If you want to jump into the Thirsty Mage Patreon and start getting some of those back, some of those new episodes, like one on Queen's Blood that Dave and Casey are going to record soon. That's a good option to look into as well. But yeah, thanks everybody for joining us, and hope you have a good week. And we'll talk to you again soon on the Thirsty Mage. Bye for now.
Adios.
Ciao.